Hello and welcome to Saving Animals with Blank Park Zoo. I'm Ryan Bickle. On today's show, we have a very special guest, Amy Dickman from Ruaha, a carnivore project in Africa. And she deals with saving carnivores, lions, and painted dogs. And we're going to talk to her today. It'll be a fascinating show. And, of course, Jesse Lowry's here. Jesse, why don't you get our show started today?
Thanks, Ryan. Glad to be back on Saving Animals with Blank Park Zoo. I'm Jesse Lowry, the Director of Conservation and Research here at the zoo. And I always like to just start off taking the first minute or so to set the stage and talk about the role of a modern zoo in saving animals in the wild. Blank Park Zoo's mission is to inspire an appreciation of the natural world through conservation, education, research, and recreation. I like to call it a window to the wild, a place where we can invite the community and families, school groups, people of all ages to come and have a fun, affordable day out at the zoo and see these amazing creatures that we have here. Get that warm, fuzzy feeling that we all get when we see these beautiful animals, but then it's our job to turn that warm, fuzzy feeling into a conservation action, to something that's actually going to make a difference to wildlife populations and wild places around the world. And even though we're a smaller zoo, we still have an audience of 500,000 people a year. So we've got a great opportunity to get these messages out and really help create change for the good of wildlife. And so we do conservation in many different ways. We work to be as sustainable as we possibly can to lessen the impact of our daily business operations on the environment. We work locally to encourage people to plant pollinator habitat and use non-lead ammunition in our state's hunting activities to avoid any unintended consequences of fragmented lead. We collaborate with organizations throughout the state and the Midwest. And really one of the big things that I think a zoo can do to make an impact is supporting field organizations, those people and organizations that are out on the front lines in the range countries of the animals that we have here at the zoo. And we're actually sending our staff to the field now, too, to work for these field organizations. Mallory, one of our education staff members, is getting ready to go to Costa Rica to work at a native animal rehab facility. Dana, one of our aquarists, is getting ready to go to Pine Knoll Shores Aquarium in North Carolina this summer to work with sea turtles and sharks. And we also support many organizations like Amy Dickman's organization, Ruaha Carnivore Project. And the point of all of this is that everybody who comes to the zoo, everybody who supports Blank Park Zoo, is helping to save animals in the wild, because a portion of every single dollar that we make goes to In the Wild projects like International Rhino Foundation, Tiger Conservation Campaign, Hornbill Research Foundation, Conservation Fusion of Madagascar, and many more. And when I think about leaders in the conservation field really abiding by the holistic view of conservation that we always talk about, taking in consideration the big picture, you know, the health and welfare of individual animals, the health of animal populations, the health of the environment, and the aspirations and needs of the local people, Amy's project, the Ruaha Carnivore Project, really comes to mind as a model for success. And it hasn't come easy either. She's got great stories to tell us today about working in Tanzania to help decrease human-wildlife conflict. And many, many lions and other carnivores have been saved from this project. You came all the way from the UK to come over here to the United States. So we're so excited to have you here. Welcome again.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, we had you here last night for Art for the Wild, our annual conservation fundraiser. Let's talk about just your background and what inspired you to be the conservationist that you are. And then let's talk about your project.
Well, it's funny that you talk about the importance of zoos, because zoos were the thing that inspired me as a young child. I've always been passionate about big cats in particular. And every time we had a spare day that, you know, we could each decide to take the family somewhere, I would always take them to the zoo and just sit there and stare at lions and tigers. And right from a very young age, I was just amazed by their power, their beauty. And then as I grew older and got to sort of understand both through the zoo and other sort of channels how threatened these animals were, I really wanted to do something to try and save them.
And so you were going to a zoo in the UK?
I was. So I'm from Devon. I went to Paignton Zoo a lot there. And then over time, I started volunteering at Chester Zoo. So, yeah, so I really enjoyed hanging out there at the lion enclosure, in particular being some strange stalker. But it was really fun. And I really think throughout my career, zoos have been such an important role. And I think sometimes when I talk to people outside the zoo field, they feel a bit embarrassed almost. They say to me, oh, you won't like this, but I was at the zoo. And I think there's no reason you should feel bad about that. If you support good zoos and zoos like yours that really give to field conservation and raise awareness amongst the general public about the importance of wildlife conservation, that's such an integral part of the puzzle and one that we should be celebrating and not be sort of shying away from.
That really means a lot to us, Amy. Please tell us a little bit how you founded Ruaha Carnivore Project.
So it was almost a mistake. Some days I think that more than others. So I was always passionate about big cats, as I said, and I ended up joining the Wildlife Conservation Research Unit, which is based at Oxford University, because they had a very strong theme on big cat research and conservation. So I'd done a zoology degree. I wanted to get out into the field. They seemed the obvious place. I spent a fair amount of time there looking at UK wildlife. And then finally, I joined Laurie Marker, who runs the Cheetah Conservation Fund, out in Namibia, and stayed there for 6 years with her, which was an amazing experience. Again, their project has very strong zoo links, and really got to understand. I mean, I loved being out there, but we saw how much of an issue conflict was, particularly with big cats. So I was very interested in trying to work through my career to resolve that. And I'd always had this passion, this dream about getting out to East Africa. So I was lucky enough to meet Sarah Durant, who runs the Tanzania Carnivore Program and the Serengeti Cheetah Project. Went out to join her in Serengeti, and it was this dream, literally a dream come true. I mean, cheetahs on the car, amazing lodges, wonderful time in the field. And I sort of signed on the dotted line to do my master's and my PhD with Sarah. And she said, well, there are far too many people in Serengeti. We need people in Ruaha. I'd never heard of it. And she sent me off on this biblical trek south with this ancient Land Rover. I ended up being rescued by Catholic nuns on the way. Finally arrived in Ruaha, and there were no lovely lodges in the area we were in, and, you know, no other researchers doing carnivore work. So it was very much sort of trying to establish it from nothing, really. But on my very first night in the bush there, a huge male lion came and slept on my tent, on this tiny little pup tent, and all I had to protect me was a Leatherman knife with its little 2-inch blade and a can of deodorant spray. So it was a fairly terrifying experience. But even while I thought I was going to die, I do remember thinking, wow, this is the place to study lions and how they interact with people. So from there, after doing my master's and PhD, I ended up founding the Ruaha Carnivore Project to look at how people were living alongside these animals, how much conflict there really was, and what we could do to try to make things better for both big cats and for local communities.
So what makes this landscape special for the animals and for the people?
This landscape is incredibly important. It has close to a tenth of all the lions left in the world. Lions are far more threatened than people think. I think every time, because they turn on the TV, you know, lions are so ubiquitous. They're ubiquitous in our culture. Every time someone goes on safari, they see a lion. So it has this illusion of being really secure, and that's absolutely not the case. They have halved in 20 years. There are now as few wild lions left in Africa as rhinos. So they need to be getting far more attention. As such an iconic species, it is under major threat. And Ruaha, as I said, is so important. It's one of only six big populations left that have at least 1,000 lions. Unfortunately, when you look across the range of lions, about half the populations left have 50 or fewer animals, so they are very unlikely to persist long term. So we really need to be focusing on these big populations to keep them secure into the future. So Ruaha is just so fundamentally important for lions, but also for species like wild dogs. It has the third biggest population of endangered African wild dogs, or painted wolves, as they're known. It has one of the biggest populations of cheetahs, and also globally important populations of spotted hyenas and of leopards. So for all of the large carnivores, it's one of those really rare places that we have to focus on to maintain that sort of population of large carnivores. But also, the thing with Tanzania is that all their parks are unfenced, which is wonderful. It maintains these very big intact landscapes, but it means that the carnivores and the other wildlife utilize human-dominated land around those areas as well, and that forms a very important part of their ranges. So these cats are relying on land that is also used by incredibly poor people, some of the poorest people in the world, who rely very heavily on livestock, and that's where you have a lot of conflict between the two. And it leads to an awful lot of carnivore killing. So snaring, spearing, poisoning by local people who are just doing what any one of us would do to protect their livestock, protect their assets and protect their families. And that's where we started to try to work with them to understand the issues and try to resolve them.
Tell us more about the local people that live in this area and share these spaces with the with these wildlife.
So there's a whole mix of different tribes there. One of the main tribes that we work with are called the Barabeg, and they are a sister tribe to the Maasai, which almost everyone's heard of. No one's heard of the Barabeg. They are very similar, traditional pastoralists, so they rely heavily on livestock, particularly cattle. And cattle in these areas are not just an economic asset, although that's really important. They are critical social and cultural assets as well. You are judged by how many cattle you have. And for some people, women in particular, if you actually lose all of your cattle, you are viewed as really not being worth, you know, any sort of social standing. Sometimes women get murdered as witches if they lose all of their cattle. So the loss of cattle is so much more important than just the money that they're worth. So when people talk about potentially compensation, that's only going to ever do a fraction of the issue and resolve a little bit of the conflict. What you need to do is try to stop that loss happening in the first place, and also critically make sure that the benefits associated with wildlife actually outweigh any remaining costs. So we work on all those issues with the local people to make sure that those pastoralists have the support they need to protect their livestock, protect their children, and also then gain benefits from the presence of wildlife.
Talk more about the interaction between the people and specifically the lions. So the lions are coming and taking some of their cattle. And what other ways does it affect their daily lives?
So as you say, the attacks on cattle are a big part of it. And almost more than that, the fear of the attacks. So when you look at the data on it, the depredation isn't that high. You know, it isn't that many cattle that are being attacked. But like any one of us, it's a little bit like a terrorist attack. There's this underlying fear that it might happen at any time, and when it does happen, it could be catastrophic. So that's why people are very negative traditionally towards having these animals around, because if it happened, there's a risk that it could really tip them. They're already right on the edge of poverty here. I mean, they're living well below the poverty line. As we would see it, 90% of them are living on less than $2 a day, 60% on less than $1 a day. So these people are really in a desperate situation anyway. And if you have a carnivore come and attack their stock, it just makes their lives that much worse. So because of that, there's been a culture that the young men, the warriors in the community, play a very significant role protecting their community, often by going and killing these lions. So the cultural killing of lions is tied up with the attacks on their stock. If there's an attack on a stock, it's a reason for young men to go out and kill lions. But sometimes they kill lions anyway in a preemptive way to protect their communities. And the communities reward the young men for going and killing lions. So when we talk to the warriors, they say it's the only way that actually the young men can get wealth and get status, because when they kill a lion, they can get up to 20 cows as gifts from the community. So that sets them up so that they can then have a family, they can have a wife. And it means that also the community feel that these young men are doing their traditional role as being warriors. So all these things are very important to understand the dynamics of how the people live alongside lions.
So when you began your work in this area, how did they accept you? How long did it take to really begin working with the people and the communities there?
At the beginning, certainly they didn't accept us at all. And we just turned up, three of us, myself and two Tanzanians. We sort of camped under a tree. We had permission from the village leaders to go and stay there. And we were somewhat naive about the fact that these people might want to engage with us very quickly. It was not like that at all. We would go to the households. They would run away. There were all sorts of rumors going around that I was a witch, or that, you know, whether I was an albino. And traditionally, people in that area will sometimes kill albinos for their body parts. So there are all these elements when you're lying in a tent under a tree at night that go through your head about, you know, what it didn't feel, and it probably wasn't a very secure place to be, and we didn't have a relationship with the communities. It was actually only after about 2 years of trying to get in with the communities that we had tried everything, and I was beginning to think that we couldn't sort of work with them. And people had told me for a long time that the Barabeg in particular would not work with conservationists. And then we put up solar panels to charge our laptops at camp, and then the Barabeg turned up to charge their mobile phones, their cell phones, which just makes everyone laugh. But it is obvious that any one of us would want your mobile phone in the bush, and that's true for them too. So they were using them to track livestock prices, and it just meant that there was a reason suddenly for them to come to camp and start to observe what we were doing. And it took a long time even from then to build a relationship with them. But the key thing was to say to them, we are not against you. What we're trying to do is understand what you get from lion killing. And is there a way that we can replace those benefits through conservation rather than killing?
So let's start talking about some of the progression of the program and some of the solutions that have started working in this area.
Yeah, so there are several different aspects. The first one, the most immediate, was to reduce those attacks so that people didn't live in fear of these attacks all the time. And most of the attacks, about two-thirds of them, were happening in poorly protected livestock enclosures. So we worked with the communities to reinforce them using wire. That's really effective. It reduces about 95% of the attacks. What we didn't want to do, though, is just move the problem by 12 hours and then have more attacks on grazing stock in the day. So we worked with the Cheetah Conservation Fund to bring in specialised Anatolian Shepherd guarding dogs. And those, they look like Andrex puppies when you put them out, but they grow into very big, intimidating-looking dogs with a deep bark. So they will alert a predator to the fact it's been seen. The predator then has lost the element of surprise. There's no point in them trying to attack. So that was the first trial of those dogs in East Africa, and it's shown it can work, and the communities will accept the dogs there. So we've seen the number of attacks on stock go down significantly in the households we work with. But as we talked about, the most important thing is not just reducing attacks. You've got to make the benefits outweigh any remaining costs. So we asked the villagers what their priorities were, and they had education, healthcare, and veterinary medicine. So we've worked on all three of those themes. We twin schools so that they have educational benefits. We have scholarships, porridge projects. We have equipped clinics. We focus on maternal and infant health. And we've provided subsidised veterinary medicines. So that was all good. The communities were liking it. But the really important thing was to make sure they didn't see those benefits just as a result of the project, but specifically as a direct result of wildlife presence. So then we started giving the villagers camera traps and employing them to put out these remotely triggered trail cams, I think you guys usually call them. And then basically the more wildlife that villagers are having recorded on their land, the more community benefits they would get. And that really showed then to them a very direct link between conserving wildlife and having benefits on their land. We also engaged the warriors through a program that we worked with the Lion Guardians up in Kenya, where you have a very culturally appropriate program where the warriors can do all the roles of a warrior. They can protect the community, they can get status, they can get wealth, but through conservation. So they track lions, they warn the community when they're there, they physically chase lions away from people's houses, they stop other warriors going on lion hunts, they try and persuade them of the wider benefits to the community. So far they've stopped over 80 lion hunts happening. And they really just play that central role. And because they get literacy training, they get a passport, they get a Kenya each year, they become really influential people in the community. So they start to have that status that previously they were only getting through killing lions.
So basically you're working really hard to go in and collaborate with the people, learn about their culture, learn about the challenges of living in this area and having these top predators around, and then figuring out a way to make it beneficial to keep the wildlife around.
Absolutely. And it's really important that people understand why we might want to do this in the bigger issues. We all know, interestingly, more about lion decline here in Iowa than many people do there. So one of the aspects is telling people about this through educational films. We're just developing a local storybook based on their culture, their experiences, and the need for conservation in local languages, which is actually critical. And as no one knows better than the zoo community, getting people to experience wildlife firsthand is critical. So we take people into the park often for the first time. And you will never want to conserve a lion if you've only ever seen it attack your stock. You'll never want to conserve an elephant if you've only seen it attacking your crops. So to see elephants and lions with their families in a different scenario is such an important way of building empathy for these animals and then seeing them as something that is worth conserving.
Tell us more about those camera traps and the photos that you receive and the point system.
So as I said, you know, we had all these benefit initiatives going on, and that's very common. I think a lot of projects give benefits, but what tends to be difficult is that they are not tying it specifically to the presence of wildlife. We had camera traps out because we were doing ecological monitoring, but a lot of the camera traps were getting stolen because poachers didn't want them there. So we brought those two issues together and we said to the villagers, this is your wildlife, you are going to monitor it. And the easiest way to do it was to allocate points for every individual image of an animal, of a wild animal they got on their village land. So we have them grouped into four villages at a time. We train what we call community camera trapping officers to go out there and put camera traps in the best places they think are there for wildlife. And every individual animal gets a certain number of points. So a dik-dik, say, which is a very small antelope, doesn't cause any problems, will get you 1,000 points. And you have more points for every time for more conflict-causing animals and for more threatened animals. So a leopard, say, will get you 15,000 points, whereas a baboon will get you 1,500 points. So there are, each time, it depends on groups. You have a group of 10 baboons, and that gets you the 15,000 points, the same as the leopard. So every 3 months, we collate these points. And every 3 months, you have a big celebration in the village that has the most points. And they all trade those points effectively in for extra benefits, extra community healthcare, education, and veterinary medicine. supplies. And it's a very, very tangible link to wildlife. And it also enables them to learn more. When we show those camel trap images, they are amazed to see the lions, the civets, the caracals that are on their land. And just the behaviours that you see, it is a really good way of people feeling that this is their resource and that they can act by conserving that wildlife to actually develop sustainably within their community and get real benefits.
And it seems like it would be fun, like it's a little competition and, you know, racking those points up. And can you beat your neighbor to see how many wild dogs you have on your land?
Absolutely. It really becomes a sort of an issue of community pride, of them winning. And we get a lot of the villagers coming saying, well, we always come third. How do we come first? Because it resets after every 3 months. So we say to them, you know, you could move your camera traps to a different place. Or some of them say, you know, should we stop this guy poisoning or should we protect this bit of land? And the good thing about it is we say to them, you know the threats to wildlife in your area. You know what you can do to best protect wild animals and have, you know, therefore generate more points. So it really puts it back onto them. They own the whole situation. They decide the benefits they want. They engage with the community. So it really makes that ownership very tangible to them.
So what's next for Ruaha?
Well, we've been there 10 years now and we want to sort of have a reflection really towards the end of this year where we do strategic planning. We look at what has worked best in the communities, both from the community's perspective, ours and our partners, like the zoos that we work with. And then how do we move forward in the next 5 to 10 years to ensure we are delivering the best possible outcomes, both for the people and the wildlife. And there is so much need for projects, you know, like this. And there are great projects out there working. So we want to really build collaborations with other projects. We are part of something called the Pride Lion Conservation Alliance, where we openly share our successes, our failures. We want to build more sort of capacity and local leadership across Africa, particularly amongst women. So we're doing that as part of Pride. And then we want to offer training in Ruaha so people can come and see what we're doing. We don't have all the answers in any way, but people could maybe have a different perspective on some things that may work in their landscapes. And also we will learn from their lessons as well. So we want to continue doing what we're doing, but also we want to scale up so that we can maximize the benefits across different species and different landscapes.
Can you speak a little bit about the connection of empowering women and women's education and conservation around the world?
Absolutely. I think women play a fundamental role in this. So I think we have to make sure that they are empowered and their voices are heard. And that is true from the most local level to the international level. We see in places like Ruaha that it seems that it's the young men almost causing the problem. They are the ones going hunting. But when you look below that, it is because they are getting accolades from women. They are getting rewards effectively from the women. So we have to make the women part of the conservation so they stop rewarding it. And we saw not that long ago that a group of young men went out to do a lion hunt. And it was the women, having recognized the benefits to their healthcare, the benefits to their children through the school, that called those young men back in. And instead of rewarding them with cattle, they fined every one of those young men one cow each for going on a lion hunt. And they put in a village-wide ban on lion and elephant hunting. And we could not have done that. That took the women in particular to recognize those benefits and to act for the good of the future generations as they saw it. And I think that is true throughout conservation, that we need to see the role of women stronger and more empowered, and everything by ensuring that those girls in particular have a schooling, because that will have such an impact on their future, both for them and for their children and for their wider communities. And that goes right the way up to the top of conservation leadership as well.
Speaking of young women, we both have a 4.5-year-old daughter. How are we going to make this world better for our two daughters? And what's your message, Amy, for people who are, you know, out there in America and other places that feel hopeless, that feel like it's too late, that there's nothing that we can do to help lions in Tanzania and all these other animals that are under threat?
Definitely. I think that is a major issue, that feeling of powerlessness, that these global problems are too big and you are just one person. But we are all just one person. And, you know, if we all group together, if we all do whatever we can, then these global problems go away, because all it takes is all of us doing whatever we can to make it better. And that's what I want to say to all of our daughters, to everyone else out there, is that you can play a role in this. And even though you may think that your contribution isn't as big as it needs to be, if all of us did that, then we've solved the issues. So my message to everyone is take the action that you can, whatever it might be. And it will differ on your abilities, your skills, your resources. So for some people, it may be that they can donate money to on-the-ground projects. For others, it will be, I want to go to the zoo and I'm going to help my family sort of understand more about this and build awareness amongst their networks. Whether it's just refusing a straw in your local McDonald's or somewhere else, saying, you know, this, I don't want to be part of the pollution of our planet. You know, all those little steps, it may seem small, but all of those things together make a massive action across the world. So take whatever action you can and just do whatever you can to raise awareness of these issues.
We've just got a couple minutes left. Do you have a story to share with us from out in the field, you know, maybe about a wild dog or a leopard, some other animal besides lions?
Wow. I mean, my God, we've had so many fun encounters with these animals. I mean, one of them I remember was actually from when we were in Namibia, and we had a leopard brought in that had snapped its tooth on a trap cage. A farmer had trapped it, and we were trying to re-release it. We thought, we don't want to keep it in captivity just because it's missing this tooth. So we ended up having to take it to the human dentist in the town. And all these people were sitting in this waiting room, sort of worried about the dentist, presumably, until we brought this leopard in. And then suddenly they were all much more concerned about that. And it was, you know, it was an amazing experience watching suddenly this community of people. It became this real sort of icon of watching everyone so interested in these leopards and helping it, you know, wanting it to get better. And it took multiple trips, but we got this amazing silver tooth fitted to it and got to release this leopard back into the wild. And every time I see people's interest in that sort of thing, you realize that there is such a connection that we have with wildlife. And we just need to foster that to address that sort of powerlessness that you talked about and say to people, own that passion, you know, just give into it. It's not childish to love going to the zoo. It's not. Just embrace that and think, what can I do? How can I make these things better? Because through that passion, through that excitement that we have for wildlife, we can make a real difference, not only to wild animals, but also to the people that live alongside them.
Amy, thank you so much for your lifelong commitment to wildlife. Thank you for coming to Des Moines, Iowa from the UK. I just really enjoy spending time with you. My daughter is officially obsessed with you now. And we just can't wait to get you back in Des Moines again. And just know that Blank Park Zoo will always be behind you. Where do people find out more about your organization?
So if they look online, there's the project website, which is ruahacarnivoreproject.com. So that's R-U-A-H-A. And yeah, and I just want to say thanks so much to Blank Park Zoo, to everyone here in Iowa, and to all the zoos that support us, the other organizations. We could not do what we do in the field without all of you guys. So I think to everyone who's listening to this and is part of the zoo community, you know, be proud of that. You're really making a difference in the world that makes such an important difference to people and to wildlife.
Thank you.
Well, that'll do it for today. Thanks for joining us. And if you want to learn more about Blank Park Zoo, head over to our website, blankparkzoo.com. And you can check out our social media pages. I'm sure we'll have a couple of clips from Amy's speech from Art for the Wild in the coming weeks. And we'll see you next time on Saving Animals with Blank Park Zoo.